Hello, folks. If you've been tuning in over the last couple months, you've heard all about the Game Time app and how it can save you some serious cash on last-minute tickets to sports, concerts, and all types of shows. You know I'm going. You know it, people. I am taking the family to New York City, Christmas time, Aladdin, and I'm using Game Time. I love it. Very easy to use. Simple navigation, good ticket deals, and a lot of available venues for sports and or the theater. Well, Game Time is hooking you up for the holidays with a $10 credit, and here's what to do. Download the Game Time app in the Google Play or App Store. Click on the My Tickets section of the app, create an account, then under the billing section, redeem the code THEATHLETIC. Once again, that's THEATHLETIC, all one word. For $10 off your first purchase. That's free money, people. Credit is only available to the first 1,000 people who redeem the code, and it expires at the end of the year. That's December 31st, 2019. So make your moves quick and score last-minute tickets.
You always charge a guy with a gun. With a knife, you run away.
Thank you very much for coming to the House of Strauss, hosted by Ethan Strauss, the author of the upcoming book, The Victory Machine, The Making and Unmaking of the Warriors Dynasty, and also about KD. April 14th, it's going to be out real soon.
It's going to take you to the moon.
You're stepping down on the moon at this point.
That's right, Ethan Strauss. He's writing a book about KD.
Almost like a powder.
I hope KD paid his taxes. This week's guest on the show, Henry Epp from True Hooper. We're talking about Stephen A. Smith and how he compromises journalists.
Cut the damn music, please!
Also, weird billionaires and Jeffrey Epstein.
Weird billionaires and Jeffrey Epstein.
Weird billionaires tied to the NBA and Jeffrey Epstein.
Because majority of Russians really think that he was a traitor.
And don't forget, April 14th, the Victory Machine. By your host, Ethan Strauss. Enjoy the show.
Cut it off!
We come out of an age of existentialism, and we're now living in an age of irony.
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Hello. I want you to read my book, Jade. I'm getting excited about the book.
Did Henry have it?
Nope. In a way, Pablo and Bomani, I think, got a shitty version because it was before I made the last edits. And I busted my ass just trying to...
Hello.
Oh, yeah. Henry is kind of part British.
I was a British citizen until... George W. Bush was president.
Can you do a British accent? Is that in your repertoire?
Terrible at it. Pretty terrible.
Terrible at it, isn't it? I just know isn't it is amazing to me.
Oh, bloody hell.
Henry, where's your mic?
Yeah, hold on. I'm trying to turn on the fucking mic. How do you do that?
Probably you were on the phone with me last time I did it. Let's see.
Fun fact, this equipment goes way back to 2013 or something.
Stood the test of time. Like the UK.
There is one elusive, like the hunting of the snark, or the quest for the answer to Fermat's last theorem, or
the riddle of the Sphinx, or the Bermuda Triangle.
We still the one fact that we wish to discover, the one hard crouton fact that we search for in the great minestrone.
Ethan, how's your speed?
Does the internet sound slow?
Welcome to the House of Strauss.
God save the queen!
Mountains of money.
The fascist regime!
Forbes magazine reveals its annual list of billionaires. The magazine highlights the more than 2,200 billionaires around the world. They have a combined net worth of $9.1 trillion.
I turned off my VPN. It might have been that.
Yeah, I always think about getting a VPN, and I never, I'm just always too lazy.
They're kind of a pain in the butt.
Yeah, they seem that way. At the same time,
there's certain things you have to turn them off for, like iTunes, you know?
I feel as though if anybody is running for president in the future, they should have had a VPN their whole life because there's some access to everything they ever visited. But then again, I think you can just lie. Maybe you just lie. Maybe that's the solution.
Am I here? Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Hello.
Ethan, a VPN's a giveaway because who knows what company you're buying the VPN from? Some of them are actually been caught selling the data anyway. They're not selling it, but giving it away. But then you're like, I don't know this company. Very well could be like, you know.
I do think about this where people's old blog posts and emails are exhumed and then used against them. And we regard time now as a flat circle on social media. So we don't even act as though it happened many years ago, but punish them for it now. And I wonder if the same thing will be true of websites that we visited, that those will be exhumed and held against us. And I think the only solution is to lie or blame whoever else is in our house for whatever bad website we visited. I think that's the only choice.
The dog.
Yeah, I was looking at my dog. I'm like, yes. Is she surfing the web, that motherfucker? She loves porn.
she loves porn and ISIS, all the bad things. A very bad dog. Very bad dog. ISIS porn.
I have a technical question for my friend Jade Hoy. Do I want to automatically adjust microphone settings or do I want to manual that shit?
Keep that off.
Okay. So now off.
Turn it off.
How's that?
Like the light, switch the games, click.
Mm-hmm. Sound perfect.
Oh, well, I've been working on my voice, so.
La 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 la. It's not very good singing. I can't sing.
All right, Ethan, all set.
Jade, how does it feel to be musical? How does it feel to be a musical person?
I don't know how it wouldn't feel.
He basically is calling us idiots. That's what's going on there.
Yeah. Well, it's good that it comes intrinsically to you. That's good.
I'm trying to get it into my kids because I'm like, how did I get it into me? And it's my parents, but so it's like getting them involved with the chorus, which they are. I'm getting them instruments for Christmas.
Might be a natural aptitude. I think about that. What is my kid going to be good at? Or how do I stage manage him like one of those overbearing parents? I mean, I'm going to do it. I just want to know what direction I'm going to do it in.
It's not going to work.
It's not going to work, huh?
Well, I just – that David Epstein little chart of like what your kids are super spending their time on when they're 12 or 15 is like a counterindicator of what they're going to be into when they're 20. I think like the 12-year-old is doing what the parents are like, you better fucking do this. And then at 15, they're like, I'm so tired of you. Like they do the thing they actually like doing. Like, I think you can save everybody a lot of effort if you just like support them in what they like doing.
Yes.
That's stupid. That's some stupid stuff.
It's a balance. Huh?
That's dumb. I read Tiger Mom and I'm applying the principles. That's what I'm doing. Actually, I didn't read Tiger Mom.
You create a buffet of things. Like just exposing the stuff, karate. I don't force sports on the kids. If you want to play, go ahead.
Yeah.
You know, just do a lot of different things to see what they like doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's the only way it can be. Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know. I think
keep them off of YouTube. That's the one thing. You got to mandate the things they shouldn't do, right?
That's hard.
That's the key for me is like – that's when you kind of have to step in. Not what you want them to do, what you know they shouldn't be doing.
Please, yeah.
Life's hard, man. That's what I was thinking. I watched that A Marriage Story on Netflix, and my takeaway is life, difficult, very difficult, even for people who should be able to manage it. It's not a profound takeaway. Did you guys watch this, by the way? Did you watch this movie?
Netflix is sure I'm going to love it.
You didn't watch it with Allie, did you?
I did.
Oh, that's what someone told me, like, you can watch it, but don't watch it with your spouse.
I think it's fun because there is this natural tribal thing that happens where you do go to your particular corner and go, oh, she's in the wrong. And Allie will go, oh, he's in the wrong. And it's very natural. But really, if you're taking the movie as it's done, nobody is in the right. and it just doesn't work very well. And that's why the marriage falls apart between the two of them. And that's why the divorce gets so ugly. And it's really well designed in that way. I think it's a good movie. You know, it might have a flaw or two, but it's a good movie. And I liked it. I liked watching it with my wife. I have a take. Adam Driver. I think he's good at being Adam Driver. I maybe not the most range as an actor. Maybe he's kind of Adam Driver in everything I've ever seen him in. I'm just throwing that out there.
He's like 1.4 Keanu Reeves.
Oh, like, that's a crazy take. I never connected the two.
Yes. Yes. He seems a little more clone stamp.
Almost Johnny Depp without range. Like we give you eccentricity, but it's one kind of eccentricity. Maybe he's like a modern Christopher Walken.
I think once you have so much, like once you're an iconic Star Wars figure, like you can't, it's just got to be very hard to move freely into other characters, right? You feel totemic everywhere you go, even in the restaurant, right? You're like, I am a legend.
I think that's probably the case. But he was that guy in Girls, and he's just so similar when I see him in A Marriage Story, in all of his eccentricity. And in contrast, I think Scarlett Johansson is a very underrated actress. I think she's underrated. I think she's one of the great actresses of our time. Throwing that one out there.
I'll make the same case for Brie Larson.
Oh yeah, she's good. I don't watch enough movies to really judge. See, that's the thing. I'll throw out a take and go Scarlett Johansson is one of the greatest actresses just because I thought she was fantastic in Her as the voiceover and a few other things, but I don't watch enough movies to really know. No. I don't know. I saw Brie Larson in a couple of things and I thought she was pretty good, but I don't know the entire oeuvre of Brie Larson. She was good in 21 Jump Street and some other stuff.
I can't remember the name of the movie. I'm going to come and give it to you in a second though. Cause I just Googled it. Short Term 12.
There's a movie called Short Term 12.
It's like as high as I can recommend anything. I mean, to my taste anyway, this is a just wonderful little gem of a movie. And I think it was one of the first things she was a star in. And so that's why I'm like you. I don't see a ton of movies. I don't remember people's names. I'm a poor person to judge this kind of thing. But I just noticed her in that one, which was 2013. I'm seeing now. Rami Malek also in that one. Ever since then, she's someone I remember. So I just know that she's to me.
She was in Room, right? She was the protagonist in Room.
Yep.
Yeah, that was. I saw that. That was terrifying and also really good. It's just. I mean, maybe this will be our segue eventually into talking about creepy billionaires. But just to think that there are people like that is
power hungry maniacs. We got them.
Man. Oh man. Oh man. Oh man. I think that's going to
be all we got.
That's all we got, man. That's all we got. They're running the show, apparently. I mean, I've been reading Henry's articles. And okay, so should we just get into this?
My God, you actually did segue it. You actually did it.
You know what I was thinking about, Jade? What? It would be funny if every guest I had on, we had a segment at the beginning called Let Me Tell You About You, and I just sort of float a theory of who they are or what their personality is. It could start off interviews in a really bad way.
It's dangerous!
Drive your fucking lolly bird!
And I just sort of float a theory of who they are or what their personality is. It could start off interviews in a really bad way.
If you can't do it, fuck off.
Let's give it a whirl.
Let's give it a whirl.
Let's do that.
Let's give it a whirl.
Drive your fucking lolly bird!
Let me tell you about you, Henry Abbott. Okay. I want to back it up even more, even before all that. It's just is this the first podcast that we've done since being fired at ESPN?
Yes.
I think so. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. And
everybody clear your schedules. We're going to be talking for a long time.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, okay. So how do you feel about that and how it's characterized? Do you prefer the idea that you were laid off or that you were fired? Which do you prefer?
I don't see a big distinction there, to be totally honest.
Yeah. Yeah. I deliberated over it in my mind. For a while, you know, I didn't know because it was talked about differently. And I didn't, you know, I guess like being laid off gets you more sympathy, but it, you know, getting fired, it feeds off this sense of, or it gives the sense of, maybe this asshole did something. So I think it's probably better to be conceived of as being laid off, but yet I took umbrage at it a little bit. And I was always curious. I never asked you about that since we were fired in the same round of firings or laid off in the same round of lanes. But yeah.
That's not okay. Round of lanes. Let's write that. Let's just write that down. We'll revisit that later. I've been trying to tell myself this. I remember being like 10 or 12 and I didn't really have any good scars. And I thought it would be cool to have like, you know, some kids had like a giant, like, I wrecked my bike or I got surgery or something. And that seemed cooler to me. We were also like naive and innocent. And it just seemed like better to be more adult with more scars. And I was like, yeah, man, this ESPN thing didn't work out. Like, I mean, it did for a long time. And then bad things happened and you got a scar. So it's like, yeah, man, I've been through some shit. Like, that's cool. So, yeah, call it whatever you want. Make it sound terrible, Ethan. Make it sound like we were just, like, incredibly wronged and fired and they, like, you know, burned our houses down or whatever. Like, it just makes me feel cooler.
Yeah, let's not reveal to the people that we were actually tremendously happy a month in and we're talking about that.
It was cushy. It was pretty cushy. Never done such exotic travel in my life.
Do you have any bitterness? I feel as though I've got no bitterness over it. That it's almost like it happened to somebody else. That it's not something that really imprinted on me.
So like from like the 30,000 foot view, I'm like, this is the greatest thing that ever happened. And I'm also very legitimately, profoundly thankful to ESPN for like A, paying for my kids' college, and B, letting me learn on the job, like everything I know of value today. Right. So thank you, ESPN, for that. Like I could maybe even on this podcast, we'll get into like kind of media theory stuff and people talking about like what works. And actually I got kind of animated listening to your Stephen A conversation. So to me, like from being online from 2005 till now, every day, like the data, you get data on every single thing you do. I feel like I've learned from ESPN a ton of things about the future of media and how audiences behave. And like it, people dig into that and like, why did Deadspin go out of business? All this kind of stuff. And that's where I'm like, oh my gosh, this is driving me crazy. I get super mad about like ESPN made some choices that have nothing to do with the future of media and have everything to do with just petty politics and small mindedness and whatever. Like, so to have people analyze what was happening there from afar, that gets me animated because I'm like, no, it wasn't that.
Well, Henry, let me tell you about you. Jade, play the sound.
Let me tell you about you.
You actually are romantic in a way. You are an idealist. You didn't just create the name True Hoop arbitrarily because it sounded good. You believe in the truth. You believe that the truth will set you free. Do you also believe that the truth is profitable at this stage right now, running your own site?
There isn't a saying like the fabulously popular truth. There's a saying the bitter truth, right? So like the truth is what we call common sense when it's unpopular. Right. If we all agree, like basketball's around, it's the truth, but it's not like we don't label it the truth. So, there's some hard messages here, right? This is a longer term thing rather than a shorter term thing. But I think that, you know, it can be popular or not, but like gravity is going to be there. So talking about it isn't stupid. Let's segue into Stephen A for a second. All right.
Hey, notice when you tell people about them, it makes them very comfortable. It really just eases into the podcast, Jane. I think this is something that we need to continue.
Total home run.
Henry, you have any email open, Chrome, any of that stuff that could be clogging the pipe?
It makes Henry sound drunk when it happens, too. It's just, the truth.
Oh, it's not too bad.
You sounded drunkest when talking about that Brie Larson movie. What was that Brie Larson movie called again?
Short term 12.
That is impossible to sound sober saying that. That is impossible. Just, I was watching a movie yesterday. It's called Short Term 12.
Oh, no. That's actually the title.
Yeah.
Short Term 12.
Sir, we pulled you over. You ran a red light back there and we're swerving. Can you read this DVD box title for me right now? Can you do that for me, sir?
Short term 12.
So you're basically like My difficult efforts to be sober for this interview are all for naught. Is that what you're telling me?
Hey, it's a 3-hour time difference. It's later in the day out there.
It's still not late enough.
Anyway. It might be martini.
How's that now? I closed some things, Jay. Is that better?
Yes, it does sound better.
It sounds better, yes. But don't say short-term 12 again, otherwise it'll...
Short-term 12.
Short-term 12.
Short-term 12. So I started getting calls from my friends outside of basketball.
And he's not apologizing for it. Do I think that he might have been hard on employees that he deemed inefficient or unproductive? You're damn right he did. And knowing Magic, there's no question about it, because I've seen Magic beyond the smile. When Magic told you that he and I argued about Lonzo Ball, do y'all really, really think that was a friendly argument? I was sitting there saying, don't you draft that kid? Don't you draft that kid with the number one overall pick? What are you thinking about? Magic and I went at it. It wasn't pleasant. I'm fully aware of how Magic can be as a boss, as somebody who's definitive in his beliefs about what should be done and how things should be done. I said, you can't take that kid. If that's making Magic look bad, the Magic Johnson that I know is like, so be it. Y'all could kiss my you-know-what. This is how I felt. This is what I wanted to do, and damn it, that's what I did. And when I got tired of their nonsense, and I decided I wanted to walk away because everybody wants to put it on me and act like other people didn't play a role in decisions that were made, fine. Have your damn franchise. That's Magic Johnson, and he's not apologizing for it.
We talk about physical fitness a lot, but there's another side to the game that's just as important. I'm talking about mental fitness, people. Calm, the number one app for sleep and meditation, has teamed up with the king, LeBron James, to help you train your mind. LeBron and Calm know that your mind is like any other muscle in your body, and Calm can help you train your brain so you sleep better, have less stress, and perform at your best. LeBron and Calm know that your mind is like any other muscle in your body, and Calm can help you train your brain so you sleep better, have less stress, and perform at your best. I'm constantly telling Grayson and Sadie, sleep is the most important thing. Water is pretty important too, and exercise. But sleep in this app is going to help you get it. Like LeBron says, getting good sleep and finding time to rest is one of the most valuable things I can do for my body and mind. For a limited time, our listeners can join LeBron in using Calm with a 40% discount to an annual membership to calm.com/Strauss. That's calm.com/Strauss. Unlock contact to help you focus, ease stress, and sleep better. Get started at calm.com/Strauss. That's calm.com/Strauss.
So Stephen A. Smith,
yeah,
was the thing you wanted to talk about, which I could not have predicted. I couldn't have predicted that when you texted that. But you want to talk about Stephen A. Smith?
I do. Thank you for queuing that up so much for me. So here's the deal. I think he's a genius at making things emotional. This is not a controversial point. Donald Trump is also a genius at that, right? So everything, if you look at a Donald Trump speech, everything is heroes and villains, right? Nobody's like a pretty good guy. Everybody's like a wonderful guy, the best guy, or they're just the worst, right? So what's the point of that in media, right? The point is, it's very emotional, car crashy kind of stuff where you will pay attention to that. So that they would both have incrementally higher ratings, right? So they're good at their jobs of getting our attention. You actually, Ethan, you were talking about watching the Democratic debate, and like Tulsi Gabbard and Pete Buttigieg maybe mixed it up, and then you and Ali paid attention, right? This is exactly this. So fine, cool. Like, I don't mind people being good at that. It makes sense. It's always going to work. It's not a good way to be reasonable. Like, if you want to make good choices, it's injurious, right? So if you have read Thinking Fast or Slow or any of this kind of brain analysis stuff, like if you're being all emotional or scared or super excited, you literally can't use your prefrontal cortex. Like, it's closed off to you. You can't reason. So like, if we're going to do something like decide, like, you know, how many games a year is healthy for LeBron to play? Or in the case of your Democratic primary, like, what's the right way to finance healthcare, right? it will not be emotional when it's being useful, right? It's going to be boring. This is bureaucracy. We're talking about how to run a bureaucracy. So, like, it's actually going to work better. I mean, go look at the countries where they do have the healthcare thing figured out. It's not like there were heroes and villains and then tire fires. It was like, no, we just made it a little better and a little better and a little better. And we looked at the data and we did what works. And now people can go to the doctor, right? Like, so I don't mind that Stephen A. does what he does. I do mind that it would be substituted as good analysis, right? Like, if I would hate for him to explain like why Greg Popovich's Spurs have been a little better over 15 years than other teams, because you can't do that at a Yale, right? It's a thing that's accurate in a very sober, boring college lecture kind of way, right? Or they just like read more books, right?
I guess my counter to that is I see it as the issue you see it as in politics, but that is not what people should be getting out of politics. People should be getting out of politics the best system for running a society and maybe find some inspiration here or there. But sports, the thing that they are getting is the emotionality. That's why they're doing it. That's why they're into it. They're not doing it to go, oh, yeah, interesting. And this team has submitted more points than the other team, and so they shall be declared the winners. No, they are resonating to it in this emotional way so they can forget about whatever is going on in their life. And I think that is often not just in joy of winning but in pain of losing. I think losing is people's second favorite thing they get from sports, because that purity of the pain – it just blots out everything else. Just like you say, you're not thinking about the other things. That's the beauty of it, is you're not thinking about those other things. So I agree with you that perhaps it makes analysis worse, but it's also the exact delivery mechanism that many people or sports fans are probably in the market for.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And that's absolutely fine. And I don't want to change that. Like, it only breaks when we get to answer questions like, you know, how many games a year do we want LeBron to play? Or you know, why were the Spurs good, right? So we in sports media have mashed all of those things together, right? So that we're going to bring turbocharged emotion. That could be Stephen A.'s nickname, right? Mm. We're going to bring turbocharged emotion to every single topic. And on some topics, it works. Like, how do you feel about the Knicks right now? Like, yell, for all I care, yeah. You should, right? But if it's like, you know, if LeBron's super tired after playing three games in four nights, should you sit him up for the fifth night? Like, if you yell on that one, you're just going to break LeBron. It's stupid, right? Like, there is real science on that, and it's not simple to explain, right? Or more impressively, like, is Tillman Fertitta the best owner that they could come up with for the next team that went on the market? Or you know, will that be beneficial to the league? Like, you know, with Trump, it's like, you know, what's up with all the money that financed his campaign from the NRA after the NRA guy met with these shady Russian bankers? And then they gave $30 million Trump's campaign. Like, you can answer that in the most emotional way possible and say, this is my kind of guy. I'm for what he says, or this is not my kind of guy. But it's complete waste of time. You only have to look at all this accounting of the NRA and all, you know, this is like really long-term project that has to be done with a very calm mind. Like, that's the same thing for load management, the same thing for these complicated issues of what's the best system to make. Like, we are failing miserably in like democracy or sports fans in being like sober enough to just answer those questions in a way that matters at all.
Well, do you see any solution to that, or is that just the human condition? That people are going to be swayed by emotion, and the people who are really emotional and angry are going to carry the day.
I mean, people have built good systems all through human time, right? Like,
that was pre-Twitter. I mean, let's talk about.
No, you're right. You're totally right. Like, you know, like it is. It's a little. I have one right in front of me. Like, it's a little. Like, you know, if you were to slide the scale between like short-term emotional thinking and long-term reasonable thinking, like this is a little machine to make everything short term, right? Like, let's pretend I was digging into the paperwork around like the NRA. Like, I would be interrupted every 90 seconds by something awesome on Twitter, and that would make me have to start over. It's literally hard to think slow now, right? So it's a challenge. You know, it's new, evolutionarily incredibly new. So like, I don't think we're just going to be stupid now because, like, of, you know, you just get beat up for being wrong, right? Like, if you let's say we're digging into a boring thing like how to design a house to withstand the weather, right? Like, if you don't do a good job of it, your house collapses in a storm, right? Well, you're going to learn from that at some point, right? You might not learn before you build your first house, but as a society, like, you know, we're going to have to get better at some of these things. Like, just that's just how it is, right? Like, we're paying a mighty price in lives for just having crappy healthcare, for instance, right? At some point, someone's going to be like, oh, you know, we should probably fix this heroin epidemic, right? And it's going to take some kind of, won't be emotionally satisfying. It won't be a Stephen A. type thing, but it will be, you know, the truth, right? That this works a little better.
I would hope so. I don't know if I'm that optimistic. I'm not pessimistic either. I just don't know. Incidentally, do you know who Joe Lacob's favorite entertainer is on television to watch?
Oh, I love where this is going. And the answer is no.
Draymond Green.
It's Stephen A. Smith. He's Joe Lacob's a huge First Take fan, and he watches it all the time. That Stephen A. Smith hangs the moon as far as Joe Lacob is concerned, which has always been interesting to me.
Yeah, what do you take from that?
I think, and I write about it in my book a bit. Play that sound effect, Jade. I take it as illustrative of Joe Lacob's personality, that he's got some similarities, that there's this idea of speak it into existence, chest puffed out, channel extreme emotion, and it's married to the venture capitalist, do the homework side of things, but he is very much somebody who thrives on a certain emotionality and competition and theatricality, and so he sees Stephen A. Smith as his guy. That's who he loves. That's what he's into. So that's what I take from it. I don't think that the Warriors were built in the image of Stephen A. Smith, although that's an interesting theory. Because he wouldn't have fired Mark Jackson if that was the case, right? Stephen A. Smith was very much pro Mark Jackson. But yeah, I just look at it as an example of the way Lacob is, that he so resonates to Stephen A.
That's amazing. I wonder if Lacob would be like that if it were, you know, in his day job. If there were the equivalent media figure, would he like that kind of puffery in venture capital? Like, is it an artifact of this being a hobby where it's fun to just be like, yeah, wreck the car?
Would he be like when you watch Grey's Anatomy with a doctor and they're just going, oh, my, no. No, you don't. You can't even inject it there. No, like that's no. That's not how it works.
I got to believe he likes a little more professionalism in the takes in the stuff that he's.
Well, I mean, who is Stephen A? Is Jim Cramer that guy? Is that who yes, it is?
I guess so, I would like. Yeah.
I mean, he became what a crazy, fascinating figure that guy is. Mad Money. Is that still on? I remember that had a heyday. Is that still going on where he's in that room yelling?
Yes, it is.
And playing cow noises.
Wait, can I take this completely off the rails conversation in a slightly more off the rails way?
Sure.
So while we're just consumed by this idea that like Stephen A is the pinnacle of a thing, right? Like, and he is. Like, he's the very best at a job. I'm here to tell you, and this will affect both of you. Like, I was in a meeting where the big problem we had to solve was that nobody would watch Stephen A's videos in the app, in the ESPN app, and they would watch True Hoop TV, designed and conceived by Jade Hoy, featuring idiots like me and you, Ethan. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, what they did was they took the Troop TV videos out of the app. Now, why would they do that? Right. So that's because, like, well, here's what bothers me about that. A, you know, it hurt all of our careers. But B, there's this giant problem with this, which is what's really happening, in my view, is that studio shows are dying. Right. As soon as you make everything digital, people don't like that same stuff. Like, it's an artifact of cable television being dominant. So we're in this phase where probably Disney's entire future hinges on creating digital products that work better, because obviously cable's not going to pay the bills anymore. So what? So Stephen A has bosses who are adhered to this old model, and he's really, really good at that. Meanwhile, the whole future of the business hinges on getting like digital first things really working and driving big revenue, or it's going to be the what doomed ESPN. So what bugs me is that like the critics, people who write about sports media, just accept the premise that studio shows define success, and so Stephen A's the king. But meanwhile, every day you got more traffic than Stephen A did. Like people would spend more of their time reading Ethan Sherwood Strauss than Stephen A. But we didn't have media columnists sitting around being like, oh my gosh, how is Ethan managing that? Like instead we have this money losing product that's just, we grew up with it and it's old and we're used to it and it's programmed into us, but it has 0% likelihood of being the future. And like, but we all just sit around that as like the definition of success.
100%.
I just wonder how much of it is just platform specific though. And there are certain platforms that are great for one thing, but not great for another thing. And obviously Stephen A is great at getting a ton of viewers on cable television, which is really hard to do. But you see these things happen where somebody is taken out of their particular medium where they are thriving and put somewhere else. And it just doesn't work, even if that person was thought to be the future. I mean, I'm thinking about Lily Singh, a superwoman who has over 15 million subscribers on YouTube and does a lot of observational comedy.
Allegedly.
I know Jade is suspicious of the numbers, but let's just say she's this tremendous success on YouTube, a huge success. And a lot of her audience is quite young. I mean, many of them are probably kids. And then what happens is NBC gives her a late night show on at 1:30 a.m. And the show has been a complete disaster so far if you read the reports about it and look at the ratings. And, well, she was the future. She was on the vanguard. She was on a medium that was accessed by young people. In theory, that meant you could just put her anywhere and it would go great, but it doesn't necessarily go great because it seems as though the distribution mechanisms are doing different things for different people, and being great on one of them doesn't necessarily mean that you're great on another one of them.
Yeah, no, for sure. We're saying the same thing. I'm just saying that like to the extent there is this sad little industry of people like watching our industry, right? Like they talk about studio shows as 95% of what matters. Like there are columns about like they're going to swap this host for that host. Like that is an argument about who's going to drive the Titanic, right? Like it's stupid. It just doesn't matter. Like the whole business will hinge on something that ESPN's been uniquely bad at, right? Which is pivoting to digital, right? Like what is the ESPN thing that's going to win in Disney Plus, et cetera? Like that is really what matters. And it's not going to be a studio show. I'm telling you, because in or out of sports, everywhere they put studio shows on YouTube or in an app or anywhere where people can pick among all the things they can pick from, they just don't pick that. Like they only watch those shows because their TV's already on that channel. As soon as you let them infinite choice, they pick other more carefully designed stuff.
That could be true. I just wonder if it's so hard to do it now. It's so hard to command an audience on cable if there's not a tremendous value in just being able to do that. It might be less you're, you know, steering the Titanic than this is a bunch of gazelles traipsing through a river that is just filled with thousands of crocodiles. And only a few are going to make it to the other side just because it's so much harder now to get of the diminishing audience. This analogy doesn't really work. That's a really analogy.
So Joe Rogan is the example you should use here, right? Like it definitely helps to you become famous, to become a name in the era of television, right? So that's a big boost because you have like name recognition and you'll get people to sample, right? That's for real. You're right. Like Stephen A is not of zero value. He's of tremendous value. But my real criticism here is that we narrate the story of sports media as if it's like incremental differences within the studio show slice of the pie. But I'm telling you, like, that slice of the pie is of incredibly limited value in the future. And so like narrating that as what matters in sports media is just ridiculous. Like, think about it. You know, it's totally true what I said, right? Like every day stuff on some story in the spin.com would be read by all more people than watched all of TV. But like, if you were describing what mattered in sports media, every single person would talk 100% about TV. Like, why? Well, it's just laziness.
I think part of that, companies always fall back on the thing that made them big, right? I remember when I wrote about, when I wrote that article about why did Nike really pass on Steph Curry? Well, it's because their archetype for success, the thing that built them, the guy for them that might have been even more important than Steve Jobs was for Apple was Michael Jordan. He was a wing, an athletic wing. That's who gets the signature shoe at Nike as they conceived of it. Only recently maybe they see that Kyrie Irving actually sells a lot of shoes as a little guy. And maybe they dismissed Allen Iverson being a great shoe salesman for Reebok. I don't know. But they fall back on, well, this was the thing. This was the thing that made us big. And if you're ESPN, you're a cable company. That's what made you big time. That's what made you all the money. That's what made you da-da-da-da-da-da in the minds of the American public. It's going to be very hard to pivot away from that when so much of the infrastructure of your organization is based upon it.
Right. So that perfectly explains why ESPN would, or like, you know, the executives of ESPN would make the case that it's all about this studio show or host or that one. Right. But that doesn't mean Richard Deitch should fall for it. Right. Like, or anyone who's like a commentator on this space, it's just not true, right? It's what ESPN would like everyone to believe, that like the whole difference is like, you know, Stephen A is 14% better than the next best host or whatever, and it really matters, right? Like, that's true in a world where we all agree, you know, studio talk shows are the center of the universe. They're not. They've stopped being that a long time ago. And, you know, all these things are declining in influence, and to like go along from outside the company with the idea that like this is all that matters in sports media is just wrong. Like, why would you not want to know how you got a way bigger audience than Stephen A every day you publish something? Like,
I mean, I would like to know that, but there's also the reality. There's also the reality that if Stephen A walks around somewhere, or, you know, we could just, you know, cite our friend Amin. If I walk around with Amin, there are going to be a bunch of people coming up to Amin and recognizing him, who know who he is and who do not know who I am. And so it is a reflection of a certain level of celebrity, right? That you have that visibility if you're on television that you don't as a writer. You're just a little name at the top of what you wrote. So in a way, it does make sense to cover these things because maybe what we're really talking about isn't the product that they are the captain of, but is just them and how well known they are. And that's what's being covered.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's why I call it lazy, right? Like, it's like, oh, here's a name I recognize. Like, let's do that, right? So, yeah, meanwhile, like, Mark Cuban hired Dan Rather because he was this huge name, right? It's like, have you ever heard of Dan Rather since then? Like, he just, like, you know what I mean? Like, it turns out the name wasn't the thing, right? Like, they put him on the wrong platform and he's just another guy, you know? I think so we confuse ourselves into thinking that it's about this name or that name. And it's fine, it's fun, and mostly it's harmless. But then now and again, it's, you know, who really has influence or who can really explain what's actually happening here. And that's where, like, you know, like that day that Stephen A undercut Baxter's like difficult reporting on Magic Johnson, Stephen A does not have the truth telling chops or the, you know, analysis chops to win that battle. He just has the loudest voice. And it was very harmful that day that the loudest voice was the one that, you know, it colored a really hard job by Baxter in a way that was very humble.
Yeah, and I guess in the end, Baxter was validated.
When was this again?
I can't remember exactly the sequence, but, you know, so Baxter was working for years on this story about, you know, it being kind of tricky to work for Magic Johnson. It hadn't come out yet when Magic resigned, but then Magic was going on Stephen A's show.
I've never sat in an HR person's office in 35 years. 2 years with the Lakers. No HR appearance. Jeannie Buss, do you think Jeannie Buss will allow me to abuse the employees? If that was the case, she would have called me in. Joe McCormick would have called me in, the lawyer for the Lakers, as well as Dan, the other lawyer. It never happened, right? I'm a person who brings everybody together, uplift the employees. I've never abused an employee, and I never will.
Stephen A. had him booked as a guest, which is why Stephen A., when he made a little like social media video where he was complaining about Baxter's story. This is all, by the way, in the GQ Stephen A story. In that little rant, he was, you know, basically just mad that Baxter told the truth. And I just felt like, well, we got a choice to make there, right? Like, we can be journalists or we can be
Well, he was wrong for that, but I also think that he gets a level of respect Stephen A. does by just not being cowed. And I think a lot of people these days are scared because whatever you say publicly can come back on you in ways you can't even predict or project. I mean, a little mini example, I believe, is that you were tweeting whether the MVP race was being discussed too early, and it's impossible to keep track of everything. And Sam Amick had an article, so people were wondering, were you taking a shot at Sam Amick, which you weren't. But now that's a thing to manage. And it's so unpredictable that it's so easy to walk on eggshells in response to all of it. And I think even though what you're getting from Stephen A. is not necessarily the truth, the idea that he would have such audacity and he would not be cowed is a form of truth to people that they like and that they feel.
Oh, this is the worst. Like, this is where – that's straight Trump voter stuff right there. Like,
I mean, he won for a reason.
He is the most cowed. This is driving me freaking crazy. Like,
play a Jim Cramer cow noise, Jake.
Should I be worried about Bear Stearns in terms of liquidity and get my money out of there? No, no, no. Bear Stearns is fine.
Everything there completely wiped out. And the NASDAQ, everything and more has been completely wiped out.
The Dow traders are standing there watching in amazement. And I don't blame them. The credit market.
676. No, Stephen A. Like, just look how he talks about the small group of people he sees as like above him. And I say that in a sense because he articulates it in the GQ article that he has this sense of these kind of like that humans are not all of equivalent value. And some of them are like superhumans. He will not criticize his crew of protected people. Right. I remember Al Gore had this line where people are like, people think George W. Bush is a strong leader, but he's such a weak leader because he can't do anything to rein in Halliburton. That's paraphrasing, but he had his people that he was taking orders from, right? And you could see it in his actions. So Stephen A. is putting on a masterclass in like impressing ESPN executives and a short list of people that he cares about, which means he has his future secured from a short list of people whose butt he kisses every breath. Like, which means he can just, fire all the guns at everybody else because his career is not wrapped up with them. So he sounds very brazen, but I get to speak freely on every topic. He gets to speak freely unless it's Magic Johnson or Kobe Bryant or a short list of players that he really values, right? He's not going to tell us when Kobe Bryant does something wrong. He just won't do it.
What the hell happened? Why did you resign from the Los Angeles Lakers?
Well, it was a couple reasons. First of all, let me thank Jeannie Buss for the opportunity first. When we sat down and negotiated, I told her, I said, listen, I can't give up all my businesses. I make more money doing that than becoming the president of the Lakers. So you know that I'm going to be in and out. Is that okay with you? She said, yes. I said, do I have the power to make decisions? Because that was important for me to take the job as well. She said,
that's a perfect segue to our next topic, Henry. The people in the top strata controlling everything. Which NBA owner had Jeffrey Epstein killed? Because I think that's what you're getting at in the series of articles. I'm waiting for the next installment. I think we're leading up to there. Was it Mark Cuban? You can tell us. I mean, you can say. I mean, which one? Which one did it?
Which one seems like the kind of guy who would do that to you?
I don't know. I mean,
sued first.
You've written a fascinating series of articles that have indicated, among other things, that, man, whenever one of these kinds of scandals, and perhaps the Jeffrey Epstein scandal is sui generis, except I fear that it isn't, happens, you can find some NBA owners around that particular situation. Can you explain what you mean by that and what you've been writing about?
Yeah, there's so much. I guess for me, it really started with I was writing about Mikhail Prokhorov, and then it turns out that his childhood friend from school was literally in the Trump Tower meeting and had appeared in a congressional report as a figure in offshore movement of money in quasi-legal ways. Okay, so what's that guy doing there? Why is Prokhorov like close buddies with this guy who's in the Trump Tower meeting? And what you end up with is we're in an era now where, between 8-10% of all the money in the world is offshore, untaxable, unreachable, moved between nameless corporations, right? That's way different than it used to be. It's this, you know, giant amount of money, trillions of dollars. And that money moves around in ways that the very rich really understand. And it's, you know, once it's in an unnamed account, it's very hard to distinguish if it's like arms dealer money, drug dealer money, mafia money, or just billionaire tech money, right? It's all just kind of moving in strange ways, in and out of politics, in and out of wherever it wants to go. NBA, people who purchase NBA teams with billions of dollars go to those parties, right? They have those lawyers. They commingle with all these other people who have private jets and those accounts, right? And some of the biggest money, once the U.S. economy had its big downturn, 2007, 2008, like since then, the biggest sources of money has been kind of illicit, right? This is countries like Russia and China, where people with good ties in the government have had access to ridiculous amounts of money in ways that are almost impossible to imagine are legitimate, right? So it's just a big mess, right? Like in the case of the Nets, we know exactly what happened. Like Bruce Ratner was losing money and needed money for his giant dreams of development in Brooklyn. And then he took money for, he flew to Moscow, sat down with Mikhail Prokhorov, who had been declined as an owner before that and had some ties that made politicians very nervous. But they're like, now we're desperate enough. We're going to take this money, right? I'm guessing that Bruce Ratner wasn't the only one who got tangled up with some money that's a little messy, right? And in that vein, you can draw a line from, there's some stuff around, the people around Jeffrey Epstein include people around NBA owners in surprisingly significant ways. And not to mention, there's even, I mean, this is one of the ones that like, what will we ever do with this? But Donald Trump and Jared Kushner have this private banker, Rosemary Roblick at Deutsche Bank, who, you know, got money for them and when no one else could. And when someone wrote a story about her for some mortgage industry magazine, the only person, I think the only person, client of hers who would talk on the record was the owner of the Pacers of all people, who said he was like great because she could always get money when no one else could.
And yes, so Succession does a good job of portraying that world of those people. When you can get that money when nobody else can, it usually means that you're going to some fairly shady characters to do it.
Thank you. Yeah, forget everything I just said. Like, Succession is the explanation of everything I've been working on. Perfect. It's so perfect.
I'm amazed. I mean, for the non-NBA angle, I was just thinking, man, we really don't care about ex-presidents. It's sort of startling the degree to which we don't, because nobody cares that Bill Clinton was best friends with Jeffrey Epstein. It's just something that is this random factoid or this random thing, and nobody cares that there have been these reports that he was staying at the New Mexico ranch all the time, which that's kind of out of the way to go to the Epstein New Mexico ranch. And I think everybody, we just kind of shrug and we go, Bill Clinton's old now. Like, whatever.
It's crazy. I mean, they're really struggling with it in England, right? This Prince Andrew thing is a big
that
deal.
Interview was incredible. Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Yeah.
Quite often, if I was in the United States and doing things, and if he wasn't there, he would say, well, why don't you come and use my houses? So I said, that's very kind. Thank you very much indeed. But it would be a considerable stretch to say that he was a very, very close friend. But he had the most extraordinary ability to bring extraordinary people together. And that's the bit that I remember, is going to the dinner parties where you would meet academics, politicians, people from the United Nations. I mean, it was a cosmopolitan group of what I would describe as U.S. Eminence.
But it's, I mean, so to me, like, the, you know, I've written about a lot of this Epstein stuff. And so the morning that he was found dead, I got a million texts. And then, you know, and I was like, oh my goodness, this is just too crazy, right? It's just too crazy. But people with a strong political bent immediately were like, oh, he was murdered, I think, because it was the Clintons, because they did fixate on like one of his ties. But I mean, it's ridiculous to me. If you dig around, everyone who might want Jeffrey Epstein dead, everyone Jeffrey Epstein might have had dirt on. I mean, there's not a party or a country or an industry. Like, it's all across
this is a weird analogy, but fans often think the only fissures in basketball teams are the people they see on the television in the uniforms. And there are so many people within the NBA underworld who matter and are a part of all these things, but they can't become part of the narrative that fans are going to attach to because they don't know who they are. They don't necessarily know who Lynn Merritt is, right? Or somebody you've covered, World Wide West, for instance. So they're going to take what they see and use that. In this case, it would be the Clintons, not somebody in private equity who might be worth billions of dollars who they've never heard of.
So yeah, exactly right. I'm a little bit fascinated by Apollo Global founder Leon Black. He has this crazy story, which is there are books about this. Eli Black bought United Fruit, which is like Chiquita, right? And United Fruit had so many crazy ties to the CIA and the White House.
Part two of our interview begins with Guatemala, the ramifications of the CIA's 1954 coup. Last month, President Otto Pérez Molina resigned and was jailed following a popular uprising. I asked David Talbot to talk about the 54 coup and the role played by Allen Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State at the time.
Their original power goes back to Sullivan and Cromwell, this very powerful Wall Street law firm that John Foster Dulles ran and where Allen Dulles worked. And among their clients was United Fruit. United Fruit, of course, was this colossus, this corporate colossus that ruled much of Latin America, owned, vast acreage in Guatemala and many other countries. They weren't just a banana company. They were a multinational real estate company. They owned often the utilities, and they owned the local political elites in those countries.
This company has been tied up in just all sorts of shady, crazy government dealings. And then one day, Eli Black goes to work. He's like discovering this, apparently. And then the guy he's trying to sell it and get value for it, and he's digging through the books, he's finding things. And then he jumps out of the window of the Pan Am building, kills himself.
Jesus.
Crazy, right? And it's very suspicious. I mean, people will always say allegedly. That was a weird death.
Allegedly,
right? So then that guy, like the morning before that happened, his son Leon made him an omelet, right? And he seemed fine. Well, that same Leon goes on to work at Drexel Burnham Lambert and then starts Apollo Global after Drexel goes out of business.
3 years ago, private equity giant Apollo Global Management announced 21 takeovers worth $23 billion. And then the credit crisis hit. Founder and CEO Leon Black used debt swaps to survive, but bond investors in the companies he owns lost millions of dollars.
Joining us at Post 9 is longtime Wall Street dealmaker and Apollo Global Management Senior Managing Director Gary Barr, who then at Lazard advised Bear Stearns on that sale to J.P. Morgan. He was also instrumental in the restructuring of both Lehman Brothers and the U.S. Treasury's restructuring of Fannie Mae. Still in conservatorship. Also, if I remember, AIG, too, at least along the way. Gary, you were in a lot of these. But let's go back 10 years ago. Sort of take me to the room. You know, it's been a brutal week.
Yes.
Confidence is gone.
Apollo Global, you know, quickly raises a bunch of money despite the scandals around Drexel and spawns the fortunes of the current owners of the Hawks and 76ers, right? They were also Apollo Global co-founders. Well, Leon's one of the only people who is known and documented to have like real business ties to Jeffrey Epstein. Been seen with him a bunch of times, photographed with him, et cetera, et cetera. And, they have some charity where they're on each other's boards of charities, et cetera, and have money's moved between them for sure. And now Leon, the same guy, the guy whose dad was one of the most controversial and questionable suicides in U.S. history, goes on to have his associate Jeffrey Epstein surpass only his father as the most controversial, suspicious deaths. How about that?
Want to see who is connected to Jeffrey Epstein.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Melissa. And we have spent some time, as have many reporters, I'm sure, looking through the infamous Epstein Black Book, which does exist, surfaced around 2015. And a lot of notable Wall Street players are in there. Perhaps the most interesting, Leon Black, the co-founder of Apollo Management and CEO now. He entrusted Jeffrey Epstein with some tax and estate planning for himself over a course on and off of about 15 years or so. He also had, for a time, Jeffrey Epstein on his family foundation board, starting in about 2000 and going up through the late aughts. They spent time together at Epstein's townhouse, so there was that tie there. Jess Staley, the CEO of Barclays Bank, for many years was at J.P. Morgan. And during that time, he developed a rapport with Epstein, who was somebody that brought clients to the bank. And apparently, Epstein steered dozens of clients to Jess Staley, including helping to foster a deal in 2004 for J.P. Morgan to buy the hedge fund Highbridge, which really helped grow their assets under management.
Staley was so grateful for this help that he actually visited Epstein when he was incarcerated in Florida.
It's a little bit, troublesome there. I'm trying to find the right thing to say. I'm really debating on whether I should make a joke about how horrible the omelet he made must have been, but that should probably be cut. For too soon reasons. Is anybody else on this call?
I'm not saying anybody here?
Anybody? Anybody?
Yeah.
Anybody? Anybody? Yeah. Anybody?
I laughed. I'm working on a frame. I'm putting together a frame, and I laughed out loud. So
I appreciate that, Jade.
What do you mean he's making a frame? What do you mean a frame?
I have pictures I need framed, and so I'm listening to the show as I put together the frame.
See, we thought you were using some sort of technical speak for what you were doing with the podcast.
Yeah.
Like if I was getting a makeover, the people making me over would probably be using a lot of lingo I'd never heard before. I didn't understand, but go. I would just go with it.
It's not Henry, an iframe. It's a frame.
Henry, if you like suspicious deaths, may I recommend the JFK assassination?
I'm sorry. I didn't want to push that.
He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot.
Seriously, though, there were like 80 to 100 of the key witnesses died in the 6 years following Kennedy's assassination. That's amazing.
Does that strike you as a big number?
That's a big number.
It's a big number.
Yes. It's the Tom Haberstroh big number. I would love if there was a conspiracy theorist Tom Haberstroh who had a big number. That would be incredible.
Yeah, it's always the, you know, random guy hit by a train, you know. Okay. It happens every day.
I mean, I will say that the Epstein thing was very destabilizing for people thinking that things are on the up and up. I will say that without knowing what exactly happened or why it happened, and adding to the creepiness,
my two things, where is this woman? A, and then B.
Specify the woman. Is it Ghislaine?
Maxie Giswell.
Giswell. Yeah.
No.
That can't be the
name.
That can't be the name. It's like out of a James Bond movie from the 1970s.
I'll cut that. You pronounce it properly, Henry.
Ghislaine Maxwell, because her dad was Robert Maxwell. Sorry. Who was a
spy.
Had his own suspicious death.
Just picture Sean Connery, Madam Giswell.
There you go. Perfect. Perfect. But and then B, I've never seen a video of Epstein. Have you? Anybody?
That's the thing I was going to say. That's what makes this so – it gives it this different aura because you never see any video evidence of this very famous person existing.
I have.
Oh.
Yeah. There's a little video of Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein arriving at a party together some years ago.
All right. There's also the Andrew video too. The creepy Andrew video from peering out of his door with the women walking in and out. But I mean, I've never seen him speak, you know?
Henry, can you talk about your theory of if you see blank, shadiness is afoot?
Oh, yeah. I'm all in on this one. There are very few people in life who have like harems or collections of women who are paid to be sexy hanging around. Like it's not really a thing that happens in normal life, right?
Yeah, but, I haven't seen much of it at Berkeley Bowl when I go shopping.
Speak for yourself.
Berkeley Bowl.
I don't go in there and I just see a, you know, a rich guy walk in with a flock of women in their early 20s beside him in the organic pineapple guava section. I don't usually see that.
So I see it just after digging into all of this sordid stuff and a lot of like Russian mafia stuff. It's a giant warning sign of crime. I don't know of any examples of it off the top of my head that were not involved in crime. And I think a common reason that it would be worth all of the trouble and expense of assembling such a thing would be to entrap the people you do business with, right? Is to get them on video or to get like some woman who might testify about something, right? Or just have the ability to really embarrass them, ruin their marriage or whatever. Which is what Jeffrey Epstein, according to the testimony of many of his victims, like he was training many of those women to do just that, right? And I think there might be a lot of reasons that people would travel with harems, but I, you know, from the days of Adnan Khashoggi, right? Like he tried to buy the Utah Jazz. He was an arms dealer. He traveled that way. It seems to me to be a consistent warning sign of other crime being committed at the same time.
So it's not just an expression of power or a fantasy of the rich guy. It's often part of a strategy, is what you're saying.
Maybe we're like, you know, maybe that whole, you know, 70s party vibe, like jump the shark or whatever. Oh, right?
But the things I read that you wrote about Buss, that was eye opening as well. That was. I don't even know how he functionally did that. And you would talk about – what were you talking about? I'm looking for the quote. I want the quote of the way he was talking about all the dates that he went on and all the women he dated. And it was –
there's a line from Sports Illustrated about like, you know, one for breakfast, one for lunch, one for dinner or something like that.
It just seemed like a pathology. And there was an element of Wilt Chamberlain's claim where you're thinking, really? Is that even possible? You know, it doesn't even seem feasible. I mean, how do you get anything done? But it was, look, I'll try to find the exact quote of it, but man, and I guess it did exist in this culture. We kind of, for whatever reason, we go, that's just Buss.
Where this kind of hurts my heart, is, you know, obviously there are thousands of hurt young women out there as a result of Dr. Buss, right? And we just can't account for that, right? If you go read the profiles of him from the contemporary time, everyone's kind of like, that's our quirky billionaire. Like, who wouldn't if they had the chance, right? That's kind of the attitude of it. And
Buss in many ways seems like, and I don't want to offend because I don't know, and obviously his daughter still runs the Lakers, but Donald Sterling, but with success and without the racism. That's my best description.
It's very hard to separate the two. Like Donald Sterling was definitely trying to be Dr. Buss, right? He just wasn't quite as good at it, right? But
that's fascinating. Nobody ever talks about that he might have been looking at Buss as some sort of model of how to be.
Somebody told me that. I feel like maybe I even read that. I don't. That is not an original Henry Abbott observation, but to me, it's just like a fact. That's what he was doing. He was definitely I'm sure he was. To the end, right? Like, why don't they like me like they like him? It's a mystery to me too, right? Like, Dr. Buss just, I guess, was not around long enough to face that kind of scrutiny, maybe. But,
I also think when you succeed, people give you a little more leeway. I think that's part of it, where whatever you might say about him, whatever you might say about the morality or the dubious ethics or maybe even worse – people love those Laker memories. People love Showtime in the 1980s. So that's all part of it. You know, the Clippers didn't really give people memories.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, and there's like, you know, how we think about billionaires is weird, right? And I think probably importantly needs to evolve. But so if you're like, oh, he's a billionaire, I'm talking about Dr. Buss now, he won championships, then the rest of the story writes itself. You just go back into his past and basically everything he did was the right thing to do.
Nothing succeeds like success.
Right. And we're a little bit conditioned like, oh, like if you just had a billionaire like you, your whole career is made, right? That's like all you need. So part of you is like, how do I get Dr. Buss? Will he take my call? Right. We all kind of started to just stop. Meanwhile, at some point, now that billionaires determine so very much. So think about the show Succession you were talking about as a good example, or The Godfather is a good example. So in The Godfather, obviously he's an overtly a criminal, but at one point someone's like, oh, you have all these judges and police in your pocket, right? So if you do have judges and police in your pocket, the only thing left to police you is the media. There's nothing else, right? Even now we have an attorney general like no one believes will like just objectively police anyone, right?
It's going to be like, that's the only thing that took Weinstein down. Was Jody Cantor and others reporting. I mean, nothing else would have done it.
So then we are now like just the North Pole of wrong to think of billionaires as like, I hope they'll be my friends and everything they did was right. Right. These are just two super wrong assumptions.
Well, do you think that they are on average worse people than your randomly selected American?
Well, I really value people controlling their impulses, right?
That makes you a little more social. So they might not be just worse people, but they might just be in conditions that – I think it was Jason Kidd's ex-wife who once said – it was a beautiful quote that sometimes – I think this was in reference to finding his second phone that he was using to conduct extramarital affairs. And she said, sometimes fame takes men – to places where their character can't catch up. I thought that was a really good way to put it. Yeah.
There's this guy in England here we go. There's this absolutely incredible book called The Hour Between Dog and Wolf, How Risk-Taking Transforms Us Body and Mind. And it's by John Coates, who worked on Wall Street during the dot-com boom. And he noticed that like his colleagues who made a bunch of money on like a Tuesday in some crazy stock run-up would like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, like use more alcohol, cocaine, and prostitutes than the rest of their lives combined. And like, I'm just paraphrasing, but it ended up in a syndrome of risk taking, right? So they're actually good at their jobs because they could accurately assess risk, and then they would ruin their ability to their jobs because they just blew it all to hell. And now John Coates has gone on to do all this research, and he has this like, kind of brilliant assessment of this thing he calls hubris syndrome, which is basically after about 10 years of being a billionaire or CEO or in power, your mirror neurons stop working. So this is the part of your brain that's like, oh, I saw Ethan prick his finger and it made me feel bad, right? Like that stops working after a long time of being in power, or tends to. So I think we're seeing that like in Succession. The dad, Logan Roy, is everyone's telling him like, hey, buying all these cable companies is an outdated and stupid move, but he can't take in new information very well, right? He's not very perceptive anymore because he's been too successful for too long, like we've been talking about in some ways through this whole podcast. But so I think, you know, billionaires, former presidents, you know, these kinds of people, prime ministers, they're less likely than most of us to be forced to understand how the world works because they can just reshape the world.
Well, there's a beautiful scene in the first episode of Succession where he's arguing with Ken about how he's running the business into the ground. And he's got this view of if you're this big swinging dick, you can just make your own reality. And, you know, they told me not to buy the movie theaters, but, you know, and they said, you know, people wouldn't watch movies anymore. But guess what? They want to go out. They want to go out. I'm just paraphrasing, but, you know, you make it up as you go along. And afterwards, everybody tells you it was so fucking obvious. So there's this idea that when you've got the influence through your boldness and your power, you can shape what the world is about. And not let everything else control you. And I think there's a certain that can happen. But if somebody gets old enough and crazy enough, obviously it's not going to work.
That's just Kobe shooting in crunch time, right? Like he actually did make a crap ton of amazing shots. And so if all the strategies are crapshoots, then that's one more. Right. But if someone actually has a better strategy, you probably won't know it if you're thinking like Logan Roy or Kobe Bryant in crunch time because you're just not looking for it. You're not taking it in, you know?
I'm just picturing a Pau Gasol calling for the ball and Kobe going, "You better be sniffing your fucking armpit, Pau." Taking the last fucking shot. It's my team.
If you can't do it, fuck off.
Speaking of like getting a little drunk with power, I feel like Ethan has veered into like a Logan Roy in a very comfortable way here.
Oh, I love Logan Roy. Oh my God. He's like Republican Greg Popovich. I mean, come on. It's entertaining as hell. Just glad I'm not in his family.
It's amazing. Yeah. I love it. That show's amazing. It really is. It's just perfect. Logan Roy lurching around is I feel like in a way, everything I've ever written is kind of about like men who are high on their own supply. And like, yeah, he's the best one.
It's intoxicating. So you said you had thoughts, Henry, and maybe we'll close on this. You said you had thoughts on my going to the den of the billionaire and going to a bunker suite in Chase Center under the stands, which was rented by a prominent San Francisco billionaire, somebody where I don't think many people listening would have heard of. But if you know a lot about San Francisco, you would have heard of this person. And you said you had thoughts on it. So what were those thoughts?
I do. And so the funniest part to me was the insistent please to, you know, leave your butler suite and please go watch the game, right? Be part of the audience. That reminded me a lot. So as a parent, I spend a lot of time with young people, and I've noticed that like we've had to kind of consciously teach kids, not just my kids, but others, like that you have to clap and you have to stand up and you have to like you have a job being the audience. And if you're just checking your phone, you're telling people on stage that you think they suck. Right. Like I don't know that we had to be taught that when you and I were kids. Maybe we did. But I don't think they understand what signal you're sending, right? So similarly, the Warriors have long had the same problem at the beginning of the third quarter, right? Which is it's the hottest ticket in the world, or it used to be. And if you get it, people tend to forego it to do something that's good for them and bad for the team, right? Which is to blow it off for most of the third quarter while they're drinking and hobnobbing, right? Networking, advancing their own careers, et cetera. So this seems like a very naked version of like, is it good for you or is it good for us? Right. And that's where, Kevin Arnott's gave me this book, Lying by Sam Harris, which quotes Sam's Stanford professor, who has this line, which is everything in life is either a transaction or a relationship. So like, these are the kings of transactions and they're screwing up the relationship, right? Like they're making the city feel weird about its team from the front row.
I don't know about that. That seems almost too binary, that quote. I mean, look, I'd have to know what the professor is talking about, but
it's not too binary.
Well, but for instance, Jade is being really helpful to me as a friend in finding out people's addresses and coming up with ideas on who to send my book to, right? And I think that Jade is doing that in part because he's my friend. And I think that there are other aspects. I think, maybe there are aspects where Jade is learning about this aspect of the business and everything else. I mean, that would seem to me to be somewhere in
also, the –
Also, though.
Uh-huh. Also, if the book does well, we're going somewhere, baby.
Where are we going? Where are we going?
I don't know. It's just going to
be – Vegas?
Going somewhere
Vegas?
Else.
Vegas? Oh.
It is also the season of giving, Ethan.
Ah.
Sounds pretty transactional to me.
That sounds a little more transactional than I knew.
Wait, you didn't get the invoice?
I forgot that Jade lived in the capital of private equity, Connecticut.
I think forgot if you're on the receiving end of the transaction, then you'll always say it's a relationship, right?
Hey, by the way, Henry, in regards to the audience not participating, the kids clapping segment there, that's true with our citizenry, our actual political citizenry, right? It's the same thing. Like, people hate the government, therefore effectively saying, I hate myself because it is the government of the people, right?
Yeah.
And that's why people now are so apathetic in regards to the political situation, you know, but it's their government.
people, you know, if someone were to like, you know, like, what have you done that helped the world in any way, Henry? Like, you know, the answer would be probably not much. But one thing that is worth a penny is like, I just go be in the audience some places. I watch the thing and then when it's the right time, I clap. And then sometimes I stand up and like, I feel like that's not worth much. But like, you know,
it
like,
is.
I'm here for you. I want you to know I thought it was good. I want you to feel good, right? I want us to do my part to make you feel good for having, you know, dunked the ball or played the guitar or whatever the hell the thing was, right? Like, that matters.
It does.
We're trying to network over here. Marquise, Chris, fuck off.
What? I just want the whole show from now on in Logan. Can we just do Logan for the rest of the show? One of the last episodes, though, there's this great, great cinematography in that show. There's the when they're on the yacht and you see the poor person going out in their wooden boat to fish. And then this yacht, this gigantic multi-million-dollar yacht just comes into the screen to take it over. It's just like unreal.
Yeah, it's a beautifully shot show.
People live like that. People live like that.
My thing, I love what Logan Roy does when people come to him and try to kiss his ring and he's barely paying attention and he just goes, wah, 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 wah. Like I've applied that to my own life of people talking to me. It's almost like a Tim the Tool Man Taylor, but slurred down.
That boat part, right, is where they. I'm blanking on it. Like Ken has a new girlfriend, and they kick her off the boat, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Similarly, what's the name of the son who lives in Santa Fe with the ranch?
He's got Conrad? The Epstein ranch out there in New Mexico. Yeah. Connor. What's his
name? Connor. So Connor's dating the former prostitute, right?
And a playwright. So shout out to her.
So forever they're like trying to remove these two women from the family photo or from family gathering or from whatever it means to be a Roy, right? Well, why is that? So this is the perfect example of a transactional relationship, right? Like that photo with the prostitute in it hurts the transaction they have coming along, right? It's like Connor can't have that relationship because the family's putting a transaction ahead of it. See what I'm saying? In the end, it's about the deal.
I think it makes sense to me, but I was just thinking to myself, my Sean Connery and my Logan Roy are pretty much the same guy, but they're also from Scotland, so I think that's forgivable. That's the tangent I got on, Henry. I'm sorry. That's what was in my head during that time, during your beautiful, intricate analogy. I apologize for that. On the bunker suite situation, it is a tension. I mean, it's almost amazing to me that they're even trying to force the billionaires out into the floor, even though they can't force them. I mean, I didn't get into it perhaps as clearly as I should have in the article, but they literally had Steph Curry and D'Angelo Russell beamed into the bunker suite five times, beseeching everybody to get back on the floor for the third quarter. It is really naggy. There is some intense nagging happening because they can't just force you out. And utterly bizarre that they want this cosseted experience where you feel as though this is your home and you'd never want to leave it. And it's so wonderful to be in the cocoon of the bunker underneath the stands. But we want you not to be here. Get the hell out, please. I mean, we can't force you out, but please leave. Please leave. It looks bad. It just looks bad. Please leave all this great stuff that we have for you for free. It is totally weird. Completely weird.
I feel like meanwhile, outside the stadium, I would imagine even in this down year for the Warriors are some like teenagers who would love to be briefly in those seats, right? Which in a way is a win for everybody, right? Like you just look better on TV. Someone who's going to become a fan of D'Angelo Russell, which matters, and will talk it up and be on their own social media and talk about it at school or whatever, right? But why don't we do that? Well, because it's just too grotesque, right? It's too grotesque to have someone who's like, a young man, now move aside here because Logan Roy wants to sit here for one quarter, right?
Like, fuck off. I'm watching Kai Bowman.
That's a good one. Maybe we should just end there. That was perfect.
Dun. They play the theme.
Yeah.
Wait, Ethan, what are your thoughts on the theme?
I like the theme for Succession. I can't do it. I can't sing it.
I like the variations of the theme.
It does the Pavlovian thing of making me excited for the show, though.
The key to the theme, though, is that, can there be a slow version? Can there be a medium version? You know, can there be an extra well-done version?
I think they do it too much, though. It's like
sometimes I do, but then I think about what it's going to be replaced by, and I would I prefer the actual what they're doing.
In general, shows screw around too much with the theme. There's nothing wrong with having the same theme every year if you've got a good one. I thought Serial made a tremendous mistake replacing their first season theme with another one. The first season theme was fantastic. Everybody associated it with the show. Audio is intimate. I don't think they should have messed around with it. And, you know, it's okay if you have a little like – The Wire had these variations, right? But it was pretty much the same. I think that's fine. But I'm not complaining. If I have a theme I like, the Sopranos intro, for instance, I don't need anybody to mess around with that.
Although, Ethan, I learned something new, which was SportsCenter has a gazillion different themes. Like there have been a gazillion different musicians have like made different arrangements of that, and we all hear it as the same one when really they're giving us like way more variety than we thought we had. So I don't know. Like, I think Serial did what everybody does. It just happened to be the second season sucked. Like, I don't know. Like, I think.
I just particularly love the theme that they had for a season with that plinky piano. I was into that.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool. And I think sometimes there's mission creep. They just try to do too much because they can. And they're bored and they're working on everything else. So why not give the theme? And they're probably sick of it because they probably hear the theme more than the audience does. So they feel more of a need to change it. And so I think they get too busy with that. They get too busy with the themes that work. That's just my take. That's my take. I'm really into themes. Amin has given me a tremendous amount of shit for this, by the way, of being too precious about this. That's how I feel about it. I said we would end on the bunker suite, but you also want to talk about something that Alex Caruso said about LeBron, and maybe we'll end on that.
We don't have time.
We don't have time.
It's going to take me forever.
Is that what we're going to talk about next time?
Yeah, next time we'll talk about that. Yeah, for sure. Alex Caruso, great topic.
Okay. Well, I want to give a big
– unless you want to. I mean, but come on. This is a long, long podcast. You, me, yeah. Logan, Roy, Jade. It's taking a while.
It is taking a while. But now we've teased it. Now people are too curious.
I don't have anywhere to go.
I mean, I've got things to – look, here's the thing, Henry. I've got things to do. I'm actually pretty busy, but I value our time together.
I saw somebody saying on Twitter like that you were saying like I had to go pick up my friend at the airport now. It's like, oh, podcast ended.
I mean, it was a great conversation with Brian Curtis. My friend was sitting there across on the couch, but I didn't want him to miss his flight.
All right. Well, I think I can do a 5-minute version of this. So,
okay.
I wrote a lot on athletes being
and we're
obsessed.
Out of time.
If you can't do it, fuck off.
No, seriously, what, come on.
Doesn't feel like a safe environment to tell my story. All right, so let's say that the right number of days a year to work out to be like a world champion is 300. I think that's probably for most of us around accurate. So you need to have 65 days off, right? Most of us are inclined to work out like 100, like or 0 or 200 days a year. So the people who are on the high school varsity team or in the college, like they're just working out like a lot more than the rest of us. That makes perfect sense. However, a good chunk of them, nowhere near all of them, but a good chunk of the best of them, like show signs of being obsessive, have OCD. This is the same as like all these idiosyncrasies that athletes have. That tends to go with overtraining, right? So there's so many athletes who make it to the Olympics or to the pros or the NBA and then start showing signs of burnout because the thing that got them there was really working at the extreme edge of what their body could handle. And then when the competition steps up, they just push it even more and then they kind of break themselves because what they really need is these 60 odd days off a year, but they just won't take them. So LeBron has this life story of, you know, very, very stressful childhood. And then in seventh grade, as Brian Windhorst reported, like he ended up moving in with his family and they really put this routine into him. And he started to become extremely regimented about getting places early, getting good grades, like all this kind of stuff, cleaning his room obsessively. And since then, he has like all of these signs of being like an obsessive personality, which is great and has made him wonderful basketball player, I think the best in the history of the game, etc. Right. So it's not a complaint per se, but it has made him a very difficult teammate. He is entirely intolerant. And there are too many stories to mention of him just like shutting the door on players who do things that are normal to 20, 25 year olds. Right. You know, there's a story.
Well, can you say what the quote, the Alex Caruso quote is?
Alex Caruso said, hold on, let me get it exactly right. The New York Times has a story today about how much LeBron's been on social media lately. And in explaining it, Alex Caruso says, he's just a happy-go-lucky dude. He's just like, he will have you vaporized if you're late, right? Like, they had team meeting on the Lakers last year because he couldn't even bring himself to like have decent body language while discussing his young teammates, who he had enthusiastically proposed trading all of them away for a deal that ended up happening, right? A guy who worked with them very closely for a long time told me it's the most undertold story in sports, which is how unbelievably hard he is on teammates who are normal. His career has been this like sequence of transactions to move young people like Andrew Wiggins and Michael Beasley away from him to bring in guys who are also pretty obsessive, guys who never miss practice, get there early, like Mike Miller and Ray Allen and all this kind of stuff. So everyone's always like, oh, LeBron has this crappy roster. It's like, no, he has insisted on these old workhorses because he can't generally succeed around young players. And when he's had young teammates, he's just destroyed them, right? He's been so harsh to them, often on camera. Mario Chalmers comes to mind, but I've been told like, you know, Deion Waiters, JJ Hickson.
Well, you got a little, I kind of wish you would show us this side of him more, because I think there is a recognition that nothing succeeds like success, where it can be accepted that he is this person because he has done so well. And we can go, hey, Michael Jordan was like this to a certain degree, and so is LeBron. But there is this nice guy image, and he's so happy-go-lucky. And then you see a clip of that Instagram clip of him just cutting into Danny Green when getting caught by the camera. And it's just such a difference. You can tell that he's hiding this aspect of who he is and how he handles things. Even though, again, just like Kobe's pathology was accepted, just like Michael Jordan's pathology was accepted, I think it would be accepted if we knew.
Yeah, probably. I mean, like, you know, Kobe did that thing where he like ripped into Jeremy Lin in front of all the cameras and everyone just thought it was great. Right? That was like fantastic. It's nowhere to be found in any of the research on like leadership and what inspires great teamwork. And certainly that team was god awful that Kobe led at that time. But yeah.
So do you see, okay, so this is a big question to end it on. Do you see this as perhaps an externality of power man, of effective leaders, right? That many of the effective leaders they express themselves in this very hurtful, cruel way, or is it part and parcel of what makes them effective that they are both loved and feared? You know, Greg Popovich, for instance, famously, I mean, I know this is part of his reputation in a way, and reporters get popped. It is nothing compared to what happens internally to people who work for the Spurs. I mean, he will humiliate you in front of your coworkers in ways that are ugly and far beyond what can even be conceived of watching from the outside. And yet he is perhaps the greatest coach in the history of sports, or at least in the discussion. So my question to you, Henry, is that just something that comes with the package that even undermines what they're trying to do? Or can that conceivably be part of what works?
So I think these are people who are accepting the challenge of moving a giant rock up a giant mountain, right? And in the case of LeBron and Kobe, they're moving that rock mostly as athletes, right? So you're going to succeed by being the fittest, the strongest, the tallest, this kind of stuff, right? That they would also be super elite at like whispering in a teammate's ear would be surprising, right? That's not what they were selected for, right? None of their teammates came with them to the NBA, right? So like to them, it's not weird to me that they would be, it would be an externality, as you suggest, right? Case of Popovich, it's just, that's the other podcast we should do, right? That's a trickier thing. He's obviously gotten a lot of people to buy in. So like with Kobe, it's hard to find a lot of teammates who are like, yeah, we gelled better as a team because of Kobe's excellent leadership. Like it's more just fans who say that. With Popovich, it's more of a mystery, right? They have a lot of fancy dinners, drink a lot of wine, and maybe that makes up for it. I don't know. But I think what's important for us though is to take like Kobe chewing out Jeremy Lin, or other teammates many other times. Jeff Van Gundy commentating in the game be like, that's leadership, and he's wrong, right? Like maybe you can get away with it if you have the rest of Greg Popovich's game, but it's not helpful in our organizations generally. Right. Like we know this, like this is well established. Like you need to make people feel safe and inspired and uplifted and all that kind of stuff. And chewing them out might be something that happens and you're under a lot of stress, but it is not causing success for the team.
Yeah. I'm agnostic on it. I know I don't like being yelled at personally. It doesn't.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
Fuck off, Henry Abbott. It's the end of the podcast. I won. You lost. It's over. Thank you to Henry for coming on. You can check him out at truehoop.com. Big thanks to Jade Hoy. And I don't give enough compliments to Jade. He is doing incredible things with the production of this podcast.
Transaction!
It's a transactional compliment that I'm giving him right now. But still, it comes with love. It depends. It really depends. I refuse to accept that it's a binary, Henry Abbott. Fuck off! I built this podcast! With my own two hands.
Oh, the music. Who did you do last week, Ethan? What?
Kevin Durant. He's like Austin, Texas. Austin, Texas. It's in Texas. It's not of Texas. Kevin Durant. Well, he's on the Warriors. He's the Warriors' best player. But he's not of the Warriors.
Oh, I love it. Okay. All right, I'll see you guys. I'll send you a game.